that puts me in mind of what Bill Barnett is talking to us about with our Labor Day rally, our fast food workers, our fight for 15. Abysmal effect on family life, structures, we'll look at that. And the collateral consequences, there are several, but one of them is the children. So, the 13th Amendment, and that's the video I was going to show you. If you have a chance to go to Netflix, has anyone seen that video? Wonderful. So I don't even have to tell you just how impactful it is.
Tell us again what the name of it is.
It's just called
13.
On Netflix. It's not a DVD yet, so you have to search for it. But here's the problem. Slavery, of course, was done away with except as a punishment for crime, whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States, etc. So in other words, if you are convicted of a crime, then it is legal for you to be slave. It is legal for you to be treated like a slave, denied the privileges of citizenship, and this has taken different forms over the years. But herein lies a lot of the problem. So we're looking at criminalization from 1865, December 1865, Emancipation Proclamation. These are the roots of mass incarceration. It didn't start this century. It goes all the way back. Slaves were emancipated, and the Southern economy depended upon them. So one of the first problems was, what are we going to do with them? Where are they going? They never got 40 acres of mule. What are they going to do? And then secondly, what are we going to do? I could hear the Southern plantation farmers say, well, how are we going to survive? And you all know there was great decimation throughout the South, economically. So they came up with black codes, just about, it's maybe a month apart or so, of the time of the Emancipation Proclamation. Southern states passed laws to authorize arrest and jailing of African Americans. What does that mean? That means that now you are emancipated, nobody's hiring you, you've gone to town, you're standing around, well then at that point, you are loitering. Now, if you're white, you can loiter all day long. But if you're black, then you're going to be picked up and taken to jail, and probably before the end of that day, be assigned to where you're going to work. That's about the economics. Vagrancy Act, very next year, you're forced into employment. If you appear to be unemployed or homeless. Now, if you want to run away, we know how many slaves ran north. Oh my goodness. You want to run away, don't be captured because you'll work for no pay. You'll be just literally a slave. Forced to wear a ball and chain. There were many other, quote, offenses that were only offenses for black people. But this is the way that they were able to get workers back into the plantation, and they were able to have free labor. How many of you have seen Birth of a Nation? Wonderful film, isn't it? First major blockbuster film. It's kind of frightening, isn't it? To say that that's what our country has to say. It was our first. first major blockbuster film. It was one of the silent epic dramas, came out in 1915. This is revealing. It's originally called, we just saw those last Saturday, didn't we? Right now. Now this is interesting. The president at that time, President Woodrow Wilson, held a private showing in the White House. That was the excitement about this blockbuster film, Birth of a Nation. Provided confirmation sought by the Southerners that African Americans were criminals. It is on that video. Let me see if I can describe it. If you can help me, please do. But the purpose and intent of it was to build the KKK, and it really worked. Their membership just blossomed after this. And it was to paint the black male as a criminal. So they literally had it boiled across the screen when the black man would come up and he would look, and of course, the minstrel show back then, I call it that, and I don't mean literally, but I mean the depiction of black men was the eyes and it was entertainment. So when he arises and there is a young white girl there, across the screen it says criminal. Literally, can you believe that? 1950, it says criminal. And she is afraid for her life. She literally throws herself off of a cliff so that he will not come near her. It is too close to a lot of the rhetoric that we heard during this election in terms of the fear that was planted in us. You know, those people. That sort of tactic goes way back. This has been a serious problem. To Kill a Mockingbird. How many of you read that, saw that? It's the same issue. Characterization of black men as rapists. That man lost his life. And he had done nothing. Another thing that's on that video is Emmett Till. I'm sure many of you are familiar with Emmett Till. What is interesting is, I think it was last year, the woman who accused him, and she's even on the video, she actually came out and said, no, he didn't do it.
When I just want to interject that it's not just the movie Birth of a Nation, but if you look at cinema and look at Planet of the Apes and Tarzan, other blockbusters through time, they play upon the same fears, and that's a really chilling kind of. These are blockbuster movies through the history of cinema in America. Are really kind of follow the same kind of. Fear-mongering, the birth of the nation starts.
Thank you. Yes, they do. So from that, the lynch mobs, the brutalization, and just, oh goodness. In other words, not just lynching, but just injuring the bodies and all of those sorts of things. Unfortunately, during this period of time in the South, it would be advertised in the paper. I know this is getting a little away from our topic, but it would actually be advertised, there's a lynching. Bring a picnic basket. And people would come out to enjoy the Sunday entertainment, which was a man losing his life being lynched.
Didn't they bring their kids?
Yes. So, war on crime, President Nixon. We need total war in the United States against the evils in our city. One thing Michelle Alexander talks about is that Nixon, of course, started this war on drugs, really, and then a war on crime. Let's go down here to John Ehrlichman. Nixon's chief of staff. Our enemies were hippies and blacks. Now there's a long quote that he has, and I may have it in another place. Haldeman has a quote too. But what they're saying is, we who were on the staff of President Nixon, we knew that our problem was really, as they say, the blacks. So what can we do? Well, we can vilify them, we can pass laws, etc. But it was the introduction of the drugs and the drugs and the drugs. Started with Nixon and Reagan picked it up. Tough on crime became the only way to win the White House for Republican presidents, but we know that Clinton played a part in that also. '71, Nixon declared public enemy number one, drug abuse. It's very revealing. I do think it's in the PowerPoint. When you look at the diaries of the staff, and they say, we knew this wasn't true. They literally say that. But this was the way in which we were going to deal with the blacks. You have to face the fact that the whole problem is really the blacks. The key is to devise a system that recognizes this while not appearing to it. Paul D. I know most of you all remember him. So, this war on drugs, supposed war on drugs, what was it in its intent and what did it accomplish? It fueled mass incarceration and the prison industrial complex. It cost us over $1 trillion tax dollars and 45 million drug arrests over the past 45 years. However, the touted intent was to clean up the streets and the cities. What they have proven is it has not reduced the availability, the sale, or the use of drugs in the U.S. It has increased the prison population, but disproportionately. There was a plan. Disproportionately affecting African Americans, people of color. It frames a get-tough policy that further perpetuates the demonization, the criminalization of people of color. We think about the media, and I probably could have filled this space with many other shows. But how did we grab onto this? In our generation, shows like Miami Vice, shows like Law and Order. One of the biggest culprits that I forgot is cops. Cops. And that's one of the early reality shows. And then I am bothered most every evening. I am a news junkie, I really am. I love the news. But I don't understand why, even though we went through this in the 60s and 70s, Channel 2, KDKA, Bill Burns, etc. You all remember? You remember when he was asked to please not say it was a black man? That's what he used to do. You all remember?
Yeah.
But now, we're back to that. The black man, the black woman. And further than that, what you hear said is, in that neighborhood where it's common, I can quote that. I just heard that the other day. It's common there. But then when it's in Butler or somewhere else, the first thing at the top is, these things don't happen here. This is uncommon. Okay? Now the problem is, certainly maybe the rate of violence, etc., is larger in that inner city. But you have painted a neighborhood, and you cannot blight a neighborhood without affecting its residents and its children. So what are they feeling? I'm one of those bad people in that bad neighborhood. He said school to prison pipeline also. So we also are looking at disparate sentencing. Crack to powder cocaine. This went on for many, many years. And it landed many African Americans behind bars. Excuse me. I'm going to say in the 70s or so, when crack came out, what we're saying was 100 to 1 is that the sentencing was so much more harsh. Whereas if you had powder cocaine, which was basically white drugs that many professionals, I knew them. That was their lunchtime fare. Go back to work. But yet, if you're caught with this crack, your sentence is so much steeper. During the Obama administration, he changed that to 18 to 1, but it is still disparate. Now, President Clinton came in with the federal crime bill in 1994. Explosion of funding for the prison industrial complex. These are the things it accomplished. He took an inordinate amount of money, built new prisons across the country, increased the police on the street. It resulted in longer sentences. Again, fueling mass incarceration. It built militarization into local police forces so that there's tanks, there's armor, there's all those things in a local police force that was not there before. But with the dollars from the federal crime bill, most, even in your smaller cities, they began to arm in a more military fashion. And it set a trend for states and municipalities. Everybody's familiar with three strikes you're out, right? Brought about by Bill Clinton, relegated thousands of African Americans with no violent crimes to a lifetime behind bars with no hope of release. You could have three drug offenses, but three was three. Three strikes, you're out. And then mandatory minimums is extremely important for us to look at. Mandatory minimums basically says that the judge cannot take your situation or your circumstances into account when he is determining your sentence. There's a mandatory sentence regardless. And this, again, has greatly contributed to mass incarceration. So we want to take a moment and just look at this prison industrial complex. This is a quote from the New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander. Most plantation owners supported the institution of black slavery, not because of a sadistic desire to harm blacks, but instead because they wanted to get rich. And black slavery was the most efficient means to that end. So there's a profit motive again and again and again. Corporations profiting from prison labor, slave wages, while the workers are still confined in shackles. Okay? We looked at that in 1865, 1866. Well, this is still going on now. There are, my goodness, I'm going to say, in the range of maybe 50, and of course it changes, of companies and corporations whose products are made in prisons. And when you talk to the formerly incarcerated, they tell you, yes, We get paid 20 cents an hour. We have to work a long time to work up to maybe 80 cents an hour. Prison Corporations of America, CCA, these are multi-billion dollar companies. Yes.
In Wisconsin, I had gone to the rally, and there was a book, and there was letters written by prison inmates, and they were talking about it. They had done everything possible. They had gotten all kinds of education. They had all done everything, and yet they still, they even were in a situation where they went out to work. They had a driver's license and everything, but they were told, oh no, they hadn't served enough time and they would not release them. And I think it's because of this. They're making money off of them, so they can't release them. But they can have a driver's license and go out all day and work.
That's right. Yes. And many of them settle for that because you want to be productive. You want to get out of the prison.
Sure.
You have something to do. You can feel better about yourself.
They're hoping that if they do everything, eventually they'll be released, but they keep putting it off and putting it off. And so it's especially bad in Wisconsin.
Yes, it does.
In New York, it's 18 cents.
It's 18 cents.
In New York.
Oh, I was a little guy. Wow. This is quite the country. Governor Romney, our presidential candidate, he made his fortune private prisons. It's one of the ways that he did. And he's not by himself. There are many, many people, wealthy people, who have made that wealth from private prisons. And I want to spend a little bit of time looking at collateral consequences. We are really, we're blessed in this, that's a hard thing to say with this topic, but when a person is no longer incarcerated in the state of Pennsylvania, they can vote. And I do think it's some hours afterwards. It's less than a day, but you can vote. There are places like Wisconsin, like other places, that they will never, ever be able to vote. Then you're relegated to that second-class citizenship and you are totally disenfranchised. Not only that, there are many states in which you can no longer have a professional license. And that's just as simple as being a barber, being a hairdresser. You're not... That's gone for you as a stream of income. Educational loans. There are some places in which, and some funders, that you can get them, but there are many places, many states that deny you. These are the two things you hear the formerly incarcerated talk about most of the time. Many of you know we work with Band the Box. Right? But I'll tell you what, when I sat down with the formerly incarcerated and I said, let's take up this issue. Let's move forward with Ban the Box. They said, well, if you ban the box, they already have you Googled before you you can find out anything on Google. So it's not that we don't want to fight that, because I still think it's significant and many other formerly incarcerated do too. But we have to dig deeper.
I don't know what that is.
Thank you. Ban the box is that on an employment application, there's generally a box that says, check this if you've ever been convicted of a crime, served time, been arrested. And you know, most of those applications go in that brown file very quickly. So the formerly incarcerated, they come out with basically nothing. Many of them don't have a support system. And then therefore, how do you make it? And you have to. I remember visiting not a halfway house, but a house in Washington, D.C., where women who were released were able to stay. But you had to have a job within, let's say, 2 weeks 3 weeks. You had to have a place to stay. You had to have all of those things. If you didn't have a support system, how is that supposed to happen? So therein, we see the rate of recidivism. Not being able to have real hope. And therefore needing to wind it up back in that place where you have a meal and you have some place to sleep.
I have a question going back to the voting. I heard that in certain voting districts, it's this weird thing also that harkens back to slavery, where the prison population, if there's a prison there, it's like each of those people in that prison counts for like 3/5 or something of a... It just made my hair stand on end.
Anybody so want to weigh in on that?
It's like there are more people, they count more people than they are.
Marion, can you hear?
She can't.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. Is it true in the prisons, they keep them out of late break, do lawns by landscaping and things, but they don't give them anything to come out of prison to say that they learned these trades, so they can't get a job? Why is that?
It's a good point. It depends on the prison. Depends on the state, what they want to learn and what skills they have access to. And also, if there is a way for them to move into employment. A group of us met with Secretary Wetzel about a month ago. And he said to us that that's one of the things that he is working on and having some success across the state. In Pittsburgh, he's working with a union and looking to get other unions involved so that when people are released, they can, and they have those skills, just as you're saying, they have skills they've picked up, trades, some of them have degrees that they've earned while being incarcerated, but then you come out and most generally doors are slammed in your face, but there are unions, there are organizations that are beginning to say, we accept the formerly incarcerated. And there are some employers around Pittsburgh. There's not enough. There's just not enough. But there is a list also of employers who have pledged to employ the formerly incarcerated.
Yeah, just, Nora, what you were asking about, what I had read was that it really affects, you know, democratic representation, because it's like they look at where you sleep to count you for where you live for redistricting purposes. So because most of the prisons are built in rural areas, most of the however many hundreds of thousands of African American men who are in prison are counted for districting purposes in those rural areas, but they can't vote there. And they aren't counted in the neighborhoods that they actually come from. So those neighborhoods lose representation.
That is such an important point. Does everybody understand, Mama, what she's saying? Doesn't that take you back to an election where it was the rural places that turned the election, and we're saying, but that population is not that large. How could that be? There are rural areas, cities, whose entire economy of that city is based around prison. The guards are employed. So many people are employed. That's how that city survives. But in addition, is exactly what you're saying. They have more representation.
Yes.
Sorry, I came in late, but I must have missed this. But frankly, I have a lot of experience in criminal justice.
70 years.
The problem right now is not that much with drugs. It's the problem with drugs. That's the problem in the communities. The problem in the jail is mental health. You're taken away, not you, the government, the state, has taken away the mental hospitals, maybe, et cetera, around the city, around the whole state. And while we fought bitterly against it, they kept saying, of course, the money's going to go in the community. Well, no money went anywhere in the community. And now you have jails full. The jails are doing mental health work. Mm-hmm. There are only two facilities which the ACLU had to sue them again because they state again to make sure that they were updated their facilities. But still there are two for 100 more beds for all the good that does. That isn't what you have the big problem now. It's mental health and trying to get mental health help in the community so people don't commit the crime because of what their abilities are and don't become in jail where they don't have the same medication that they had outside. They have a formulary inside. They can't get the same medication, and you know what happens if you change your medication. Well, that's what happens in the jails. And it's serious, and that's what I think, frankly, people ought to put their attention to that and somehow get their legislator to know there has to be more mental health money going into the community to keep people there instead of in jail where they will deteriorate very quickly.
Thank you. That's another thing. When we met with Secretary Wetzel, that's all of us were agreeing that that's the largest mental health institution in the state, are the prisons. That's where they are. We closed baby. I mean, I couldn't say it any more eloquently than you did. Thank you so much. And it is a serious problem. And we're not paying enough attention to the fact that we've got to do something. And people are in prison just for lack of any place else to be. Yes.
I also read about a small program somewhere. Since a lot of people in prison, it's because of drugs, which means a lot of people are addicts. But there's a prison, and I don't remember where it is, but they started a program where they're doing rehab for addiction in the prison, so that by the time they come out, you know, hopefully they're free. But most prisons aren't doing that. So they come out and they're still addicted, and then they, you know, the cycle continues. So it's like, yeah, duh, you have them at this place, why can't you be doing, it's part of a mental health thing, but, you know, why can't you be doing the programs to help them get, you know, rid of their addictions?
And that's part of the charge of the prison, is to rehabilitate.
But yeah, but
sometimes we lose sight of that, but that is the intent of the prison.
You have upstate poverty.
Yes.
And but along with poverty is education. Right along with that. And in this article in it's in New York State, George Will wrote it. He wrote about the college is in New York State in the prisons. But anyway, he said 61% of New York inmates have fewer than 8 years of education. And that's not this big. We know education is, you know, that's right connected. And New York now does have quite a good system about education in the prisons.
That's wonderful. The statistics in Pennsylvania and in other states are also startling. The statistics basically say the same thing, that those who are incarcerated generally are don't have high school diplomas, don't have any means to really take care of yourself. We know how much our economy has changed. You know, when I was in high school, Pittsburgh was a labor town. You know, my cousins were going to follow their fathers into the steel mill and make a living wage and support their families. And so many of those types of professions are gone. You know, and so what do you do at this point if you have no education? And one of the things, I'm not sure if it's on the slide or not, that talks about education, talks about the children, I think it's right. Okay, no, there should be another one.
Well,
that's okay.
We'll see.
But basically, what it's saying is, oh, it's on the other one. That's okay. That's what we'll get into in our press. The point is this. When it comes to educational attainment, we all know there's an achievement gap. But beyond just a gap, there are so many fewer black males that are graduating from high school. And then they still have families, many of them children, and if not that, at least their mother and their that family that they want to help support. That's part of the driver into the drug trade, because that's a living wage, and many times beyond that. One of the things Bill can tell you with fast food workers, etc., many of them are not just teenagers. I met a fast food worker here in Pittsburgh who was, he had been working at McDonald's at least 16 years. And he had worked his way up to about $9 an hour. But he couldn't raise his kids, he couldn't. And most of them are working two and three jobs just to try to, even when they're simple, to try to keep a roof over their heads. So that's another thing we really have to.
Two things, just to hit on that one. I literally just was speaking with a young lady. She has two children. She works at McDonald's. She says that they don't even give her 20 hours a week, number one. And then number two, I was going to say that a lot of the times the federal prisons have a lot more resources. But I know, I have a family member that's been in for 15 years, and he's in the state, he's in Schuylkill, and they don't have access to internet. They don't have access to education. They don't have access to get school. And he's been there for 15 years, and it's like, it's like I can't even fathom how a person is going to be rehabilitated if they don't have access to anything to give them substance.
And it does depend on the prison. I'm sure some prisons where. Look at people in solitary confinement, which is another huge issue, of course. And in their little cell, because they're lifers sometimes, is full of all kinds of things. You know, you're wondering, and not necessarily access to internet. Although, at that same prison, one of the inmates had received an iPad and was going to be able to communicate via that iPad. It depends on.
I think I heard the statistic, and I don't know exactly what it is, but it related to young black men, 18 to 24, whatever. There was way more in prison than there were in colleges. And that was like.
Well, I'll tell you what, you will find that there are people who dispute that, say that statistic isn't true. I'm not interested in disputing it. I'm saying there just plain aren't enough black men, young black men, who are going to college and finishing. And you can go to most of our colleges, even state colleges, and see that. There are more black women than there are men. Also, it's a matter of dollars. We talked about a federal crime bill and all the $1 billion that it dropped into police forces and into this criminal justice system. At the same time, and particularly now, the education budgets did not go up. You know, we could have easily, if we had worked on it well enough, had some free, at least 2-year tuition. So the question is, where is our money going? Where is it going? And if we're putting it into criminal justice, we're not seeing the results.
This is a broadly quick question, but could you comment on, you know, what's happening now with the opioid crisis and the at all the deaths. Where we go?
I think we have to be careful because we're being set up to repeat this pattern.
Yeah, that's my view. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I mean, the same kind of policing tactics, the same things that led to, you know, Bill Clinton and the Republican Congress when they put all of those things in place and he signed them. I'm not giving him leave, but I think subsequently, you know, there's the recognition that that wasn't good policy.
Now
that we know that, how do we bring pressure to bear if we don't repeat the same thing that Nixon and Sessions and these people want to do now? We're going down the same road.
Yeah.
Good point. The president, in the last few days, you know, he's made a few comments, but he has also taken this opportunity to reinforce his stand on law and order. That takes me back to, I believe it was Fannie Lou Hamer. I think she was referring to President Reagan, but she is interviewed and quoted as saying, "We understand what law and order is. We get that. That means that you'll be coming into our community and arresting us in full force and calling it law and order." And she went on, but so we have the revival of that word. Now that word has been tainted in many ways. The question is, why would we resurrect that? And one of the things I wanted to show you tonight is that there is intent. It's systemic. It is a system. And unfortunately, we look at New Jim Crow, and I think she named it that because of second-class citizenship. Not having so many things available to you. We look at Jim Crow times, and you may have had a water fountain, but it wasn't the same. You know, you may have had a neighborhood, but you didn't have services, that sort of thing. But what we're looking at with our prison industrial complex is slave wages and being detained disproportionately. One of the other things, we have to take a moment to talk about our school to prison pipeline. You may certainly weigh in on that. But that's something we're looking at, we have been for at least two decades, all over the country. There are many, many components to that. One of the things that came up in the beginning was the fact that the builders of prisons were looking at third grade test scores. And from that, projecting how many prisons, where the prison would be. And I heard people fight against that and say, that's not really true. But I've also heard them say, yes, we are. We are. And we're building those prisons. And we're building them based on the achievement or lack of achievement of students in particular areas.
Actually, I'd like to say a little something about that. So I heard the same thing that they based it on test scores, but an important aspect, when researchers look at these standardized tests across the country, the only thing that they actually correlate with is income level, is poverty. It does not have to do with academic achievement. It has to do with how much your household has in terms of money, really, and so really what they're doing is they're basing prison where they're going to build prisons at with where are the highest concentrations of poverty. That's the truth.
That's true. But also you find that achievement gap in the places with the highest concentrations of poverty.
Yes.
Yeah. We're in this state, though, we are closing prisons. Remember this just recently remember the Greensburg? That was a big thing, closing that prison. And then there's another prison that's just been closed. And I don't know now about the private prisons. I don't think that they're, I know there was a lot of money on Yeah. And the cash for kids, they all went to a private prison.
Yes.
And, yeah.
Do you want to elaborate on cash for kids?
Well, it wasn't, yeah. What property was that?
Reserve.
Yeah. Well, it was really, really bad. These children in junior high and high school, females and males, and in Luzerne County, if they, right in high school, they would be, if they did anything, just anything, they went to prison. And the common pleas, and some of them didn't even have representation or anything. And they built a private prison to hold all these kids. And this went on and on until, and I don't know why the parents, you know, didn't do anything. And right in high school, they would say to them, and the common pleas judge, they'd say, we're telling him, and boy, you know, if in high school, they would say that to them, and in junior high. So this went on for several years, and a private prison, because there was a horrible prison they were going to, so a private prison was built, and our district attorney's brother was one of three that built...
That's right.
Yeah, that built this private prison and in Luzerne County. And it finally all came, and it was a newspaper that just...
The judges got kickbacks, right?
And they were getting kickbacks, and I don't know about the people that built the prison, but they
were the ones paying the other.
Yeah. Anyway, the common pleas judges are in prison, and it took a while, and it's impossible to even believe that something like this could happen just a few years ago. I mean, just impossible.
It's tragic because you think of all the children's lives that will never be healthy, will never be the same. Private prisons, generally, they contract with the government. And there are some private prisons that will sue the government. In other words, they can sue the government. Why? Because their contract says the government has to fill up their beds.
Oh, yeah.
So if the government has to fill up their beds, then you have law and order.
And if you don't, we're going to charge your small town because we're in rural areas.
Yeah. And the government's not going to be sued. It's going to fulfill its
tax dollars.
These kids didn't even have representation. And in this state, I guess there was a law that juveniles didn't have to have representation because it's so hard. You know, the public defenders and all that. Yeah. So a lot of them had no representation when they went up before these judges.
Very nice.
Yes. There's one other situation that's cropped up. I had a little lot of things to talk about, and that's recently, very recently, around here, and that's the problem with the unionization of personal care and medical, and specifically competitions really between two big unions. One is SEIU, which traditionally worked in that area, and the other steelworkers. Now, steelworkers traditionally were high paid jobs. Steelworkers over the years, because of the loss of jobs, are steelworkers, spread out through everything. And now, that including personal care and hospitals. And the problem with that is...
In prisons.
And prisons, a lot of things. And the problem with that is that they are competing with each other. In this case, the employer ended a contract with SEIU, and some started a contract with the steel workers. And he's the base employee. A contract to be out is $4 less than it was previously. Steel workers $4 plus an hour. That is the kind of thing that is really biting, especially low income people, black people, so those jobs that need. And those are largely black people right now.
And our health care in our right in our city, our health care in our prisons.
That's right.
Who wants to talk about that?
Well, Marion can talk about the health care in the prison.
Yeah. There's lack of there is some health care, but not enough health care to do half of what a quarter of what you need to do.
Right.
A lot because when you're a child where the family is broken up, there is mental health problems. There are mental health problems. They aren't being addressed. The schools aren't all the teachers haven't been acclimated to how to handle children who are mentally ill and who are in depression and various things. I don't fault them. I think a lot of it is there are some of them, a great number, haven't been as trained or as others. Many, they're certainly trying in the school system to do this. However, you've got to get kids who are awake, who haven't been trying to work or fetch money or do something at night, that in the morning you get in to talk to them and they're falling asleep. So they gave 15 minutes more at one of the schools just recently in the paper, big news. And there actually one kid said, yes, he came to the school and actually he was awake, which he hadn't been before. So I don't know whether it's 15 minutes or 20 minutes, but children, I know I went to the school and talked and the kids were falling asleep. It was early after lunch. So you fall asleep, you know. And they do. And a lot of them are on getting free lunch. And that's embarrassing also. It's terrific for them, it puts them in a different classification. And that's a rejection that has to be somehow taken away. It's really a major problem that seems to be solved in every country except the United States. And I sort of can't think, we're not that bad, we're not that stupid, we should be able to do what they do in UK and in Holland and in Belgium, etc. Why, and even in Germany, why aren't we doing it? And I really don't know. Actually, I really do know. But and what I do know is what came up just in Virginia. And that's the hate that's been there all the time. And we haven't recognized it, and we have pushed it aside. And nobody, you know, said, oh, it'll go away, time cures everything. Well, it did, and it doesn't, it interrupted. And now we see it. And I think that's what a lot of the problem is. If I had an answer, you know, I'd spread it around, but I have no answer.
Just briefly, I wanted to pick up on some of the comments you made about mental illness and talk about how practices like solitary confinement induce depression and more mental illness. And I've learned in the last couple of years that there's a neurobiologist at Pitt whose name is Michael Zygmunt, and he has done research on laboratory rats that are in cages with other rats and ones who are in isolation. And he has come up with data that confirms all the negative things that we think happen in solitary confinement, but he has showed that in animals as basic as rats.
I think it's only in this country, isn't it, that we have solitary confinement?
I can't answer that.
But that was my raised at the last oversight board, because they get juveniles in county jail. And they've been juveniles they have in county jail are there because they committed charged with committing a crime that is a felony, would be a felony, and otherwise they'd be a truman. So the response I got from the judges was that these are basically bad children, or bad people, and they have to be kept in solitude. We don't want them making other young people feel the same way they do, so we keep them in solitude. And that's, you know, screaming about studies, et cetera, et cetera. And they don't have that thought in mind. They see the crime that they're alleged to have done, and they say that's a vicious crime, they're bad, poof. And you've got to somehow figure out they may be guilty, but they're right now they're innocent. So you've been, you know, they haven't had their hearings. So they aren't treating them as though they're innocent. They're treating them as though they've been found guilty.
No, true. I do know that one of the real efforts that Secretary Wetzel has been about and is continuing is to get juveniles out of solitary confinement. We need to keep working. Not enough has been done. But he's made the progress. So that's all coming.
I think it's important to remember that the people who are in the Allegheny County Jail, the majority of them, are awaiting trial. They are not convicted.
So
Allegheny County citizens need to know that. Secondly, we need to begin fundraising to pay people's bails to get them out of the jail. There's efforts going on in America that we need to start having funds that help get these out that are awaiting trial, because especially young children, their families waiting in there.
Yes.
So that's like a doable, measurable thing that we can get on.
Yes. And your point is so well taken. It's happening all over the country.
Right.
That they're doing away with bail sometimes. Money bail there.
Right.
You should be able to
require judges to do that because.
Yeah. So true. So many people are in jail. I looked at the statistic today. Too many people are there because they can't pay.
Right. They have to bail.
And it costs us, as taxpayers, it costs us much more per day to keep those people there. So it's even good business to get them out of the jail.
Well, but then somebody's
going to be very
income. In terms of private prisons, we have one that's been left in Pennsylvania, and it's mainly housing immigrants. But not exclusively.
The other thing that kind of shocked me is not only are there a lot of people in jail because they can't make bail, and so we ought to be working to change the system to get rid of that system, but there are also a whole lot of people who end up in jail because they've been in jail and they get out on probation or on parole and they violate the terms by doing something that would be perfectly legal if you or I did.
Right.
So if they associate with someone who is formally incarcerated, that can be a violation that can, by itself, send them back to jail. And I think the other thing that is really shocking to me is just when you look at all the collateral consequences and three strikes, you're out, all of those things attach if you also entered into a plea bargain, right? And so many people enter plea bargains because they're afraid of those draconian sentences.
That's right.
And they don't have to be advised of all of the collateral consequences they'll face by entering a plea bargain.
Even if they're innocent, they go plea bargaining now.
Because they're afraid of it.
Yeah.
I just want to say that it's so striking the way that the whole system is completely unable to create. I mean, it's no secret how you educate people. You put money into education. It's no secret how you want to create jobs. You have to you start projects. But the system is completely unable to put one and two together. There's a bunch of people that want to work. There's a bunch of work to be done. It can't happen. Furthermore, we're talking about people that are in prison that haven't committed a crime or simply don't have the money to get out on bail. Meanwhile, there are cops that are videotaped shooting unarmed people, and they don't get convicted. There are bankers that crash the entire world economy, and they don't get put in prison. So the entire system is completely just not functioning right now. And it's no secret. It's not terribly hard to figure out what needs to be done. The problem is a problem of power. We need to organize, and we need to assert ourselves as citizens that we have the answers. If it's up to the people in the community whether to build a prison or a school, the people in the community aren't going to have any hesitation at all. They're going to build a school, and so yeah, we just need to start organizing.
We hope so, and it makes sense that they would do that. However, remember, at the base of all of this is profit.
That's right.
It's money, and it may be more profitable for that city to build that jail.
I'm wondering, so the guys out on the streets in Charlottesville Friday and Saturday with their torches, all bullshit. I wonder how many of them had spent time in prison and had come out with nowhere to go. I'm just wondering. Do you have any sense of that?
How many of the white guys?
Yeah. Probably none. Right? They were preppies.
Well, you know what?
I have a relative in prison. I have a relative in prison who was raised in a pretty nice middle-class family. And this guy sounds pretty bad. And some of his rhetoric sounds disturbingly like stuff we've heard from these crazy guys. So, I'm very worried about him for whenever he gets out, which is not going to be sometime soon. Yeah, but I'm just thinking of him and wondering. Is there a
connection? I want to point out something, though. A lot of the statistics and information I gave tonight, I talked about black males, and I talked about, remember the word disproportionate? And showed that with some of the statistics. But I would say at least half of not more than the prison population is white. Is white. So we shouldn't think that there's nobody white in prison. Of course there is. And too often we do that with welfare and food stamps too. You think it's all black people. There are many more white people on food stamps and welfare than there are black. But it's a matter of disproportionateness. So I'll tell you what, I work with an organization called Healing Communities. We go into churches. You're familiar? And to get the churches to come alongside the formerly incarcerated and those that are still in prison. That's one thing I haven't talked about, what the children, but it's the families and the children who are basically incarcerated. We call it parental incarceration. And they're in great need. Too often they go to their church and people don't want to sit by them, to associate with them. That's that bad seed. The kids are ashamed. This is interesting. This is what I wanted to share with you. Dr. Trudier, who heads up this program called Stations of Hope and Healing Communities, he goes across the country, although he's headquartered in Philly, to teach churches how to minister to the family, to help with the visits, to do so many things, and to bring about reconciliation between the victim and the perpetrator. When he goes into church, he's been at East Liberty Presbyterian and other white churches and black churches, etc. Every time he says, who in here has a family member or someone close to them? Who in here is affected by mass incarceration? There's hardly anyone that's not standing up. I don't
care what kind of church you go to, what kind of group, what, you know. So the reality is we are all affected by this. And even if it's not a family member or someone close to you, just our economy, our educational system, all of these different things are affecting every one of us. So we've got to really understand that. I really, really appreciate the ideas, and I'm feeling the energy and the passion of people saying, we've got to do something. We can't just sit and say, this is sad. But we've got to really mobilize and do something. We have a healing communities. We're going to make some probably final preparations, but there's a speaker coming in from Pennsylvania Council of Churches that's going to talk about school to prison pipeline. That's going to happen in November, December. It will be on the Penn website and also on, we'll definitely let the cold know, and hopefully that word, because I know they're coming here from all types of congregations.
No, what?
What is he speaking about?
I didn't hear you.
School to prison pipeline.
Okay, yeah.
Then we have other speakers coming in November, I believe it is, that will be talking about just prison conditions, mental health, solitary confinement, those sorts of things. I will make sure that the word gets out so that you'll be able to benefit from the dynamic speakers, just dynamic. And then we have one coming up in January. Another thing, as we're talking about actions, Penn is a part of GABALI, which is our national organization. We are an affiliate. And what Gamaliel is planning is two actions each year at the state capitals across the nation. Same day, same time, we'll be at the state capitol for a rally, to talk to legislators, making sure we have key issues that we're dealing with. Now, the issue that's going to bind us all together has to do with relegation to second-class citizenship. In other words, restoring the citizenship rights of the formerly incarcerated. That's not going to come up until March. You'll hear more about that. So there are a lot of things going on. I see another hand.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to mention a couple of more individual things that people can do in Pittsburgh. There's an organization called Foundation of Hope. That provides mentors, that is to say, you volunteer to be a mentor with somebody who is either still in prison or is just out of prison. And then there's another organization called AMACHI, that's AMACHI, that matches mentors with the children of prisoners. There's a very large number of children, as we've seen, who have more parents and children in prison. And obviously, they're in a lot of difficulty. And this organization has a 92% record of success in keeping these children out of the criminal justice system themselves.
Yes, they've just really grown in success rate over the last 10 years. I've been watching them and connecting with them. They're doing great things. I'm watching it. All right, I want to share with you about who I call my child. I pastored a church in the Cathedral, and I had a family. This was 2011 to about 2014 or so. And there was a young man who always came with his family, beautiful family. They kept in touch with me after I went off to my other church. I got a call from her not too long ago. He's 15 now. But when he came, he was maybe 10 and 11. Very precocious, very spiritual young boy who always wanted to share with the congregation what he was praying about and what he felt the Lord was impressing on his heart. So they found out, the mother arranged for visitation, and they had just started picking up this very young infant and bringing his son to the home for the weekend, etc. So I think it was maybe Super Bowl night, etc. The child was there. The child had a little bit of a cold. She had swaddled the child very tight. The child was lying beside him. When he woke up, the child was breathing. Tried very hard. They all tried. They tried like crazy before the paramedics got there. They jumped in. The child did not respond. This young man is 15 years old. And when they first did the autopsy, etc., they said, I don't see any foul window. Well, but then it went to the DA, and it's the DA that's responsible for determining the charge. And so one day he's in a class at the Keys Court, and about four or five policemen converge on him in his school. He's 15 years old, throw him in handcuffs. He walks outside, and there's a whole sea of cameras saying, did you kill your child?
How did they
have? I was in the child's funeral. I mean, this is a broken, that child looked just like him, and he loved that child. He was broken. So what am I doing? I talked to the mom yesterday. Thank God he's a model child. He's just a model young man. Grades, everything. And he had enough people to speak up for him. They decided to hold him over for trial. He went directly to the adult prison. Downtown. He's still there. But I did get a call. I haven't been able to return today. I think he may be home. Not today, but in a week. But he's awaiting trial. Of course they've asked for a plea bargain. Because when it comes down to it, there's no real evidence of a foul play or anything else. And they said, well, if you'll take, what is it, 9 years for manslaughter? Well, of course, that was my response. So he's just such a young man of principle. He said, no, we're going to fight this.
Good.
So they're going to fight it. They have very little money. But I'm asking this. I'm asking that when it comes time to stand up for this 15-year-old, that we're visible. Again, I know many of you are connected with others. I'm going to put that word out there. That we make a visible presence. Because we don't have to prove whether he did something wrong or not. I know this child is just horrific with the whole thing. But he's a child. So what about rehabilitation? He doesn't need to get that, but still, we should be looking at something other than how long have we locked this child up for? And ruin his life for 15. So I'm asking you,
where is he right? Man. Where is he right now?
Allegheny County Jail. Well, he's downtown. He's been there for a few months.
But those are adults. He's not 18.
They
yet.
Took him directly there because they charged him with manslaughter.
Okay. Yeah. No.
So I don't mean to hold you much longer because it's certainly dismissed. Okay, but I did want to appeal to you. If anybody else has anything, I want to thank you. Your input. I did in terms of your sheets.
Thank you very much.
I think there's only one true one.
The first one you saw was 70 years.
And the rest of those are not. Okay. All right. Well,
thank you.
In this piece that we haven't even touched. So we'll be be in touch.
We'll have to come back.
Yes, yes.